Welcome to episode 8 of Decoded, a podcast by Marriott Digital Services, where we bring together the smartest minds, best leaders in digital space for a 10-part series on all things digital marketing. My name is Mike. I'm Director of Program Management for MDS, and I'm joined by Chris Robinson, our Director of Customer Success. How are you, Chris?
Wonderful, Mike. How are you?
Good. Are you enjoying the weather?
I am. 80 degrees, sunny. Life's perfect.
I got the window open, so if you hear a bird throughout this, you know, just enjoy it. So we are joined today for another news roundtable by one of our dear friends. Justin Abrams is here from BrightEdge. I think if you guys remember from the previous episodes, we had another partner from BrightEdge. His name was Ryan on. He joined us for a news roundtable. We have Justin with us today. Justin's worked with us on several webinars. He's been a partner for us on the organic search performance and customer experience side of things. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Chris, Mike, it's a pleasure to join you guys today. I'm excited for our conversation.
So are we. So you're another player from BrightEdge. You do a little bit of a different role from our friend Ryan. Can you tell us about what you do at BrightEdge?
Absolutely. So for those who don't know, BrightEdge is a leading SEO enterprise solution. We help organizations from all over the world of all different shapes and sizes to gain as much insight and, of course, execution in their strategy for organic search specifically. But we also cross the channels and help organizations to distribute SEO methodology throughout the digital mix. I'm a senior SEO consultant, and I have the pleasure in the professional career of working with some of the most recognizable brands on the planet, Marriott being one of them, to help organizations drive not only the most value out of BrightEdge as a technology, but also to be as up to speed and effective in digital and organic specifically.
It's a great tool, and we enjoy using it and working with Justin. So let's get into a couple stories for the week. We'll start with one that has absolutely nothing to do with SEO, but is generally an interesting topic. So I think we've all known 2020 into 2021 has been an interesting period of time or year if you spread it across two calendar years. I don't remember the last time I was at the movie theater. I don't remember when it was. I know the last movie I saw was the crazy Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie. But I think if you're based on the East Coast where we are, movie theaters are starting to reopen, of course, with some degree of restriction and distancing and so forth. We won't get into that, but they're reopening. We're also beginning to see that movie theaters and studios are beginning to cross release. So there'll be a movie dropped in the theaters, either same day or a fast follow is a drop on a streaming service. That may or may not be associated with having a higher cost or a cost even akin to a actual movie ticket. So we've got Black Widow from Disney coming at Disney Marvel coming out in a handful of weeks. It's the first big blockbuster release. I think the world's been pent up to see something like this. They've purposely kind of held it back. And that's been a strategy that's been scrutinized for a while or embraced depending upon who you are. Probably the next big one after that is James Bond in the fall, which had its release date, pulled back like three times, I think. And that's what I'm quite excited about. So Justin, Chris, do we have any movie plans and what do we think, cinema plans. And what do we think that this whole change does to streaming and movies? Cause it's a really, really interesting time.
Here's my take on it. I don't think I'll ever step back in a movie theater ever again. I didn't particularly enjoy it to begin with, to be honest. But now you've given me the taste of getting a fairly new movie in my home where I can pause it when I want. I can get up and walk out. I can tell my children to be quiet. I can do it all at my own pace. This is one of the things where I'm like, the pandemic didn't cause this. It just accelerated what is happening, right? And this was going to happen anyway, the rise of HBO Max and Amazon Prime, like the amount of, we probably churn through 3 to 4 movies a week. It's not a disdain for not wanting to watch movies. It's the experience which they give you for the cost in which they charge you. So we will see, but that's my take as of March, 2021.
Wow. So my wife is just like a movie fanatic. One of those that's just gonna, when she sees a movie she's got to go to, she's cannot wait to buy her ticket, go to the theater, go to the lounge and Barca Lounger and get her drink order and all that good stuff. you know, I think for us going to the movies is like such an interesting pastime. And like for our generation, it's something that we all grew up with and, you know, anxious to continue to explore. I can't agree with Chris more though, like the convenience aspect of this and like the diversity and, you know, the ability to just be comfortable in your own home. And, you know, the start and stop is absolutely like a primary feature. I don't have to go and like miss half the movie to go stand in line at the bathroom. But I wonder how movie theaters, specifically cinemas, are going to adapt, right? Like maybe it'll be more of a true experience, like a Broadway, you know, where it's like not necessarily for everybody. Maybe it comes at a premium. Maybe they adapt movie theaters to be, you know, micropods, you know, like think about like dinner in a movie or like your own cleansed ecosystem. You guys can watch it in like a smaller screen, but an immersive experience. I don't know, right? Like organizations are thinking about incredible ways to adapt that real estate. Like, what do you do with all that real estate? I don't know. So I'm anxious to get back to that time where that's a thing. I don't know if we're going to be going back so fast, number one, but we'll see.
One thing that we did do in the summer of last year was a drive-in movie. So it was like transporting back to the 1950s, right? They had the old speaker by the car. It was like the perfect experience for summer of 2020. I can see that, like that it was packed, right? But I can see that going further and further, because again, it was a similar thing where you drive up, you take your own stuff, you pay for the tickets, you can buy stuff if you want, but you weren't sort of obliged to do it. Fantastic experience.
Well, I think you both said it right. It's different types of experience around this. It's like, I have two young kids. So for my wife and I to get out and go see a movie is kind of a cool experience, Justin, of like, it's the date with the movie, right, with the dinner. Right. I miss that type of stuff. That would be cool. I will kind of play devil's advocate to myself and say, I think this has kind of taught me that there's like two levels of movies I care about. One is like, I need to go to the theater to see my Star Wars and my James Bond, see like Soul, which I loved with my son, I don't need to go to a theater, but I gladly would pay more money for something of that quality. So I agree. I think it's definitely kind of like with streaming music a decade ago, this thing could just kind of force the trend that was already in motion. So speaking of trends in motion and getting into what, you know, the heart of actually what we do for a living, which is SEO and digital marketing, Justin, apparently there's some crazy stuff going on with Google zero click searches. What is that and what is going on and why do we care?
Yeah. You know, zero click search, definitely a hot topic as of right now. If you follow some, we won't name drop here, but if you follow some well-recognized digital experts and SEO practitioners that we all kind of hang on their words to try and drive our own strategies, you know, there's lots of different dispute around zero click. And this isn't a new topic, but I think that there's new study that's probably igniting this conversation a little bit again. So zero click, you know, if you're familiar with a search result page, there are several elements that exist on a search result page that just satisfy the user's experience immediately without actually passing the visitor to the website that ranks for that particular position, right? We see this in a couple of different places. You see this in like quick answers. You'll see this now in the video experience with suggested clips and the ability to just play that video right within the Google search result page. Google Maps can be a significant zero click experience. Images could be a zero click experience. All these different elements that exist on a search result page, and like the list goes on, we know there's like dozens and dozens of different highly contextual search experiences that really map to Google's core goal. Right. So like, who's at fault here for zero click? Google's primary mission is to sort and order the world's information, right? Like the internet of information. And their secondary goal is to provide us as consumers with the information that we need for the moments that matter for our lives. Now, where it gets a little bit hairy is they rely on the organizations of the world that are actually the thought leaders, that are actually the ones that hold this conversation, to be able to provide that level of trustworthiness and accuracy. And that's where like this discrepancy really comes into play, right? Google is leveraging all of this information for the benefit of the Google experience, you know, and the question is, are they at fault, right? Like, is that the wrong way that they should be operating their search engine environment? And we all know that they're not the only search engine, and there are other search engines that do it a little bit differently. you know, but I could go half, you know, six in one, half dozen on the other for this particular topic, because I understand Google's mission and it directly maps to the critical need of that mission. But I also sympathize with the organizations. And as an SEO, you know, we chase our tails on this effort, right? Like, if Google's going to steal my click, should I even waste my time putting myself in that position? Well, if I'm not in that position, is my brand relevant? Am I synonymous with that user's experience? You're kind of stuck in this, you know, where do I fit in as a digital organization? Me, I, you know, very well coined myself as a human experience marketer. And regardless of how Google is going to take my information as an organization and distribute it intelligently to, you know, the world to consume, from the human experience perspective and as a digital marketer, the commitment to excellence and the commitment to creating the highest quality content, the most trustworthy and authoritative content that I possibly can, that will never go away. Regardless of how a search engine is going to consume it, you know, my goal is to be part of my community's entire overall experience. If you got to lose a little bit to Google's market share, so be it. But yeah, tough conversation. What are you guys thinking about this over at Marriott?
It comes down to how do you determine performance, right? So often when you hear people talking about, oh, zero click is bad and Google are bad because they're doing X, Y, Z, they often want to see it from a performance angle, right? But if you lift it up a level and say, okay, well, how do we determine what success is in digital or in digital marketing or whatever it might be, and say, okay, well, we're no longer going to track digital success by the number of room nights or the number of visits that we get from that particular channel or that particular segment, but more by the overall health and performance of the company, then this problem sort of goes away in some ways. But I think ever in the corporate environment, you're always going to have different players wanting to report on their particular sense. And what search engine marketeers have to do is determine, how do they show value when this is in play? How do they show value for the work that they're doing? And that's just a natural corporate instinct. Whether it's right and whether Chris believes that should continue is another thing, but that they will have to continue to prove value throughout the rest of this year.
I think that's an interesting way to think about it, because I mean, I personally, like, I'm a Washington Post subscriber. I read the app. We pay them an amount of money every month and year, and I get my news directly from them, right? But what I also find myself doing is I follow them on Instagram and I read all the context. They basically put like 90% of the story into an image where it's like you scroll and you get the whole story. And I don't think this is any bit different than that, right? Like, that's free to anybody. And it's like, it's the platform owning, it's an understand that like the content producers feed the platform and then you just consume the platform. Whereas like, I think this is, I mean, every couple of years this gets really hot. And I think it also ultimately fuels for like 3 seconds and SEO is dead type of thing, which we all know it's never going to die. But I just think this is just one of those natural things of like, it's going to make news. As marketers, we're going to have to defend it and explain it and say it's about controlling real estate. But I mean, I don't see Google backing down, Justin. I think it's like, it's their mission is to control everything. So, you know, people are going to be cranky, but it's what it is.
Yeah. You know, here's what I think probably could be a nice takeaway recommendation for this section, right? Like, Google is pretty much telling us, what are the most important conversations that the consumer audience cares about? Whether you're generating the click from Google or not, it does not take away the need to listen to that indication. And then as you distribute that knowledge across your digital ecosystem and start advising the rest of your channel experience, where there isn't this disruption, where there isn't this, you know, let's call it a self-serving initiative by the search engine, that's really how we create this true human experience of marketing. Right, like the cross-channel digital ecosystem where we inject logic of SEO into the entire digital mix. Right, you guys know me very well for that conversation. And this is exactly that. Like, if we are going to lose the click because we're in that position, the knowledge of that position existing in the first place should fuel the rest of the methodology and the rest of the channel experience as you serve your consumer. And Mike, your example is exactly perfect, right? Like, you're consuming maybe the same content. It might be the same story on multiple different mediums. And that's not by accident, right? Like, that's a savvy organization that has an SEO first mentality and simply is redefining SEO instead of search engine optimization as the human experience of marketing. right? And trying to really understand what are all the different ways that I can engage with the same consumer, drive the story, become part of their, you know, their journey as an individual and be synonymous with the needs that they have in their life. So I think it's interesting. I agree with you 100%, Mike.
So speaking of interesting changes in consumer interactions and cross-channel and omni-channel, all that stuff, could you also tell us, Justin, what is going on with the general environment of cookie tracking and cross-channel collaboration there? I think there's little bits of, you know, the 49 states of the U.S. don't have a problem with cookies. One does or one doesn't. And then seemingly Germany and France look like California. So Justin, what the heck is going on with cookies?
Yeah. Well, first of all, like, what is a cookie, right? Like, it's actually like a really cute little name. It's existed for a long time, but like, what actually is this thing? You know, a cookie for just very easy digestion for everybody to understand is an internet spy, right? Like, this cookie is designed to follow us as individuals all over the internet and decide where our lives take us, right? What are the organizations that we click into? What are we searching for on Google? How are we engaging with, multiple channels throughout our day and so forth? But the goal of the cookie is to accurately understand me, you, as an individual consumer. And that information is then distributed to advertising organizations to ensure that where they position their advertisements are targeting individuals that are actually looking for these moments in their lives. Now, as a marketer, this is like a pretty critical experience, right? Like, I need to know what my consumers are looking for. As an SEO, I use Google to perform that analysis. Right. If I was in ad space specifically, I'd probably be turning to some of this cookie level information to understand my consumer audience. Now, we're aware of this long life cycle of cookies, and a lot of different countries and states have, you know, real concerns about quote unquote privacy. But cookies are not necessarily going away. Just an advertiser's ability to access cookie information is going to change. So instead of being able to target me, Justin, you, Mike, you, Chris, as an individual consumer, you're going to be put into a cohort, right? So now we're going to understand not necessarily me as an individual, but that my tendencies meet this general description of a consumer that does these behaviors, that's of this demographic and this location and so forth and so on. So it's the search engine's job, right? Like, to understand me as a consumer, hyper-personalized search result experiences, making sure that my experience is unique to me and incredibly valuable to me. But that information also helps us as we get targeted for things from an advertising perspective, right? It's how I know right now, you guys know I'm about to welcome a baby in the world. That's the number one thing that I get targeted for. And it's not a bad thing. It's actually super convenient. It allows me to understand what are the different products that are out there, different services, solutions. It's truly listening to me as a human and trying to pair me with, again, the best organizations that are out there for the products, services, and solutions that I need for the moments that matter to me in my life. So from a state, from a country level, I definitely understand, like, hey, it's a little big brother, you know, it's a little bit intrusive. But at the end of the day, from a marketer's perspective and as a consumer, this is your normal. This is how you're consuming your data, right? This is like how you ensure that the news that comes into your living room and the commercials that are displaying on your television are accurate to your life. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter. It would just be content with absolutely no measurable result out of that.
As a marketeer, I can see one aspect of it. You know, marketeers want as much information as they can to really hyper-focus their advertising and their message. I get that. And then there are a select group of consumers which feel that they shouldn't have access to that level of information and they shouldn't have that piece. And I understand that piece too. I think from my perspective is like, take my DNA and give me the best possible experience. Like, I have no interest in like limiting that type of information, because as a consumer, I don't want to see an advert on the TV for an Aston Martin because I can't afford an Aston Martin. I want to see but you see how, like, I just want the best possible experience as a customer, and that's fair. All as a consumer, that's kind of all I want personally.
All right, Chris. So can you tell us, you're a father, you want the best possible experience in whatever it is you're doing. Instagram is launching a kids app. What is going on here?
Yeah. So, well, Facebook, so all, well, Instagram, they're a Facebook company, is working on a Instagram for kids aged under 13. So the head of Instagram confirmed that there is a version of this popular app that we all use that's going to be available for children that are under the age of 13. The Facebook owned company knows a lot about what, you know, kids want, but there isn't really a detailed plan, is what they've said. Normally when they're speaking public about it, it probably means that there's a detailed plan somewhere. They're just not being very public. He said that parents want to have transparency and control. So make of that what you will. During the conversation though, he referenced comparing it to Messenger Kids. So my kids use Messenger Kids, and this is a platform that launched back in 2017, and it allows kids between the age of 6 and 12 to talk to each other, right? And as a parent, at the end of each week, you get a summary of how many messages they've sent, how many calls they've been on, what photos they've shared, and who they've shared them with. And there is a very good control aspect of it. It's pretty good. My kids use it. I would be supportive of it. It's ad-free, so I'm not getting questions from my kids about why can't we have this or whatever it might be. However, any product which is online targeting kids under the age of 13 is, you know, has got challenges to overcome. It's got problems with regards to privacy and legal issues. I was reading about in September of 2019, the Federal Trade Commission fined Google actually $170 million for tracking and viewing histories of children to serve them ads on YouTube. So again, you can start to see how this is a little bit on rocky ground already. The project is being overseen by the head of Instagram and another VP. And interestingly, that VP was at YouTube looking after YouTube Kids. So I think that person will understand what the requirements are. As a parent of three girls, this scares the living crap out of me. It really does. Because so my daughter is on a tirade at the minute about wanting a TikTok account. She's 8. And every day it's like, can I have TikTok? My friends have TikTok. Can I have TikTok? And we have this out clause where it's like, you have to be 13, right? Because that's the terms and conditions. And that is our sort of safety blanket in some ways. If that safety blanket is removed, then it worries me a little bit. It would have to be significantly controlled from my perspective. And it would also have to be ad-free because they're my sort of two benchmarks, I would say.
Well, I'm not a parent yet, so I don't really know how I would feel about this whole thing. You know, to me, first of all, from a business decision, there's definitely an opportunity for the business here to speak specifically to this consumer demographic, right? Like, kids are consumers too, but their parents are the ones with the wallet. So I agree with you that it has to be ad-free. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be free of content influence, right? And there could definitely be that opportunity there. I'm interested to see how that, you know, turns into the very young influencer, right? Like, I think there was a study just recently that the number one revenue producer of YouTube is a child. It's like an 8-year-old kid that does toy reviews. I read this recently and I forget what his name is.
Ryan, the Nickelodeon show.
You might be right. You might be right. So like, I wonder, you know, are we starting kids too early in this, you know, era of social media? I don't know that just yet, right? Like, it was not a thing when we were kids at all. You wanted to be an influencer, you got to be like the cool kid on the block that like just got a brand new pair of Jordans or something. Like, you're now, I don't know what that experience looks like. And then how does that follow them? If we memorialize a child's content, you know, like, how does that follow them as they become an adult? How is that taken into consideration for the college admissions experience? How is that taken into consideration for, you know, the activities that they participate in and like the long-term experience of a child? So I don't know. I would be right with you, Chris. I'd be like, find some way to block, I think. I don't know.
For me, it clearly, there's a strategy here from Instagram to bring the population or users into their ecosystem earlier, because they know that once they get past 13, then they go onto the main app and that leads through the various different aspects. Interestingly though, I remember talking to my niece and she's older than 13. So just keep that in mind. And I noticed that she had deleted her Facebook page, but she had kept her Instagram page. which seemed a bit odd to me. And I asked her about it. And she said, well, look, grandma's on Facebook and I don't want to see her to see what I'm up to, but she's not on Instagram. And then firstly, you're talking about my mum, so let's just hold that back a little bit. And secondly, now grandma's got an Instagram page. So she's now then progressing into other social means, like whether it's TikTok or Snapchat or whatever it might be. And that's where I think, you know, a kid that's 12 bordering on 13, are they going to want to be in an environment with 6-year-olds? To me, there's a long way to go, but it is borning a group of younger influencers, I think is the best roundup of that.
Yeah. And one of you, I forget who said it so well about like this, I think Carissa was used about like, this is a Facebook company, right? And it's like, I think Facebook has to have this like life cycle system of like, the young folks are here, the older folks are here, the working professionals are here. And it's like, I've seen some folks that, you know, I'm in my 30s, so I'm old at this point, but like treat Facebook like a LinkedIn profile of like, it's, I'm here, I've checked the box, it exists, but it's here so that my mom doesn't find out bad stuff I'm doing on the weekends, right? I mean, to jump back to Instagram for a second, I think it's neat that there is like a closed box experience that they're building of, in theory, it's like safety net. We tried actually YouTube Kids for my kid, and we both got really frustrated with it because he had used like regular YouTube. And like, even though there's ads and stuff, you know, so how to skip them, but like, we couldn't get all the features and we both were a little frustrated by it, which I guess I'm outing myself for letting my kid on YouTube and so forth. But I mean, I think that's one thing that's we got to look at too, is like what features kind of move over and are they the right ones? Do they work? Do they lock? Do they only say like, oh, it only works in landscape or something? So I know it's minutia, but it's like those types of things I'd probably look at it as a parent and be like, is this going to go or not go? However, I am terrified about the whole idea of any of my kids having an internet presence. So we'll close it out there. So Chris, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, we all work in meta search to a degree for what we do. We're tracking places like Yelp, TripAdvisor, all those folks. But what has Kayak done?
So they have built a hotel, which has always been the talk of the town a little bit, where you heard Expedia maybe building their own place or booking.com as their own hotel. So to step back a little bit, as you mentioned, Kayak is a travel agency and a meta search engine. It also runs other platforms like Hotels Combined that people might have heard that as well. So this hotel that they are building is in Miami. It opens in the spring of this year. It's called the Kayak Miami Beach Hotel. It's what they determine as locally inspired, but it's a small hotel. It's 52 rooms, but it's all powered by Kayak. So if you go on there and you make a reservation, it's all powered by their kind of booking technology, if you will. It's located in the heart of Miami Beach, which I'm sure is a vibrant place to be at the best of times, but especially right now. But it's a historic hotel that they have converted. Through some research, though, they've really integrated technology, which I kind of like. So they've built the ability for guests to message hotel on a 24/7 basis. They've got the ability to request upgrades through their app, unlock the door and things like that to your hotel room, all using the Kayak app, and receive on-property notifications and room-ready alerts. And instead of a human checking you in, it's a kiosk, and you go there and you check yourself in. So very similar to if you've been to a Citizen M hotel, that's a very similar experience to that. My perspective, it's a neat setup, great technology. It's a good, neat idea. It's a booking provider or a traffic provider, if you put it that way, turned hotelier. Will they have 7,000 hotels in 30 years' time? Who knows, but we'll see.
I think it's a cool one too, of like, it's almost like when there was, you know, Virgin Airlines, we got Virgin Hotels, we got Virgin Galactic, and it's neat to see like a platform create a presence. Cause I can't remember the last time I've or ever seen something like that before. But I mean, I think this is one of those things where it's like, it probably is like a cool capital experiment of like, you know, some group got a little bit of funding. They're going to try it out. I remember this almost feels a little bit like a couple of years ago, like National Geographic had hotels for a little bit. I have no idea if those are still around. I have not researched it. I don't know, but I just think it's really neat to see people kind of like taking risks like this. So it'll be exciting to see and track it. And 50 rooms seems a lot easier to manage than a 500 seat, a big box. So,
yeah. Interesting.
So Chris, keeping it with you for a second, then we'll do a fun topic and then we'll end it. You know, you're an adamant deep reader of analysis and economics and trends and so forth, but you had some really cool findings out of the most recent SCIF recovery index, right?
So the SCIF recovery index is ultimately what they determine as a real-time measure of where the travel industry is at large, and basically the core verticals within it. So hotels, flights, all of those good things. And through the COVID-19 pandemic, they've been monitoring basically what they call the recovery index. And the recovery index is a mixture of leading and trading indicators that take into account a number of different factors, whether it's the destination performance, the microeconomic performance, unemployment rate, industry production, kind of all these different factors. There's about 45 factors which go into sort of making up this score, and they track around 22 different countries around the world. So they're not just looking at the number of airline passengers or the number of people in hotels. They're looking at all those things, but they're looking at them in combination and coming up with a score which helps you determine ultimately the health of travel. So early March, or about March 10th, they announced their February data, and they announced that the recovery index stands at 49 points relative to if the same month last year was 100. So it's about half of what it was in February of last year. So if you think about the pandemic, February in the US at least was fairly normal. So March, I think, will be the true comparison of like, how are we from a health perspective? Looking at the individual countries, the US was at 62. So ultimately, if it was at 100 last February, it's at 62 now. So it's clearly down, and everybody understands the reasons why. Interestingly, it's the highest of any country. So to me, that was wild. I was like, that, you know, there. Outwardly bound looking, there are countries in a maybe a better state, but are there countries maybe that are traveling as much, as many airline passengers, as many hotel stays, all of that good stuff? And interestingly, it was up slightly by sort of 8 points from January. So that's good.
If you take it on face value, 50% feels kind of reasonably normal right now, right? I feel like if you look at, I mean, where we live in Maryland, like restrictions are slowly beginning to move to somewhere around 50 to 75% capacity for any business that's types of reopened. Everything's beginning to thaw. That seems like a really just good gut check, right? Because I feel like sometimes you look at this big survey you did and you're like, that doesn't make sense. I don't agree with it. But that one feels right on the money. And I love that comparison to previous years too, of like, you know, I don't know why there would have been, at least, you know, year before, any major concerns. But if you look at it across like big events in the world, it'll be fascinating to see, like, do they have that data against things like SARS, 9/11, like those types of things, of like, what does it all kind of look like? So it's fascinating stuff. Do you have a take, Justin?
Well, actually, just, you know, have a question. I'm not familiar with the report, so I have to take a look at it. But I'm wondering if they're actually taking into consideration the category of travel, right? Like, is it, individual travel? Is it business travel? Is it family travel? Is it historically, it would be like for sporting events, or it could be for conventions, or, you know, are they breaking this down into, you know, consumer categories, so to speak, or is this just like the macro trend of, are we getting back to travel?
It's really just the macro trend. So it's more just looking at lodging, flights, whatever drive holidays, whatever else it might be. If you go back to April of last year, their sort of score was at 17 for the US. So it was like 17, like if April 2019 was 100, April 2020 was 17. So that's how far it's come, which is wild. And interestingly, if you actually look at One of the metrics they're looking at is lodging intent. So the intent for customers to stay in hotels of or lodging of some sort. And they do put short-term rentals within it. But and within the data, you can actually, they're pretty open. You're able to download all of the data in a CSV file and split it however you want and integrate it in reporting however you want as well. So in February, the lodging intent was 85% of what it was in February of the previous year. So I think, again, that's a positive story. In April, that was down at 20%. So again, the world is recovering. Exciting times is on the card, but I would say here the recovery has started, but is not quite here, which is a call out maybe to the next podcast that we have already recorded, but not yet released, which is with a gentleman called Adam Sachs. And he is far more intelligent, industry-wise and data-driven than I will ever be. And he talks for, was it about 40 minutes, Mike, on all things recovery, travel trends. So we'll let everybody know when that's released. But that is, if you're interested in the travel recovery cycle, that's one to listen to.
He's a really smart guy. Learned a ton there. So why don't we wrap it on an extremely light note, but connected back to SEO, which is our bread and butter. Justin, Google's made a couple updates to how you can leave a photo based on your experience at a location, either through maps or directly through any of the Google apps. So why is this important and why is this different?
Yeah, you know, like, this is something I had to like think about for a couple of minutes because I'm an avid Google reviewer. Like, I really just rely on Google reviews for my own experiences, whether it's like I bought a bicycle last summer, like to figure out the right bike shop for me or a restaurant or wherever, right? Like, I rely on them as a consumer of that information, but I also give back in my ability to leave a description or a review, and I'm always as accurate as possible. And with leaving a review, you're compelled to also leave some photos of your experience, right? Like the classic one is of a restaurant, like take a nice picture of your dish. And like, of course, leave that with your nice or your poor review or whatever. And like, I never really noticed that you couldn't just upload your photo. And now all of a sudden, this is a brand new algorithm shift, which leads to an incredible change in consumer behavior, but more of a convenience feature, right? Like Google is realizing the need for image consumption. This also is now going to give consumers the ability to just visually leave a review. No words, right? Picture's worth 1,000 words over here. Now, for me, this feels like also, again, like taking it back to maybe one of our first topics here, which is a little bit of a self-serving Google initiative. We all know that, you know, Google works very, very hard to see pictures, right? Google can't see pictures. They can read pictures, but Google is getting much, much, much better at seeing. And I think that this is also just a really interesting way of, you know, incentivizing, we'll call it, not tricking, but incentivizing consumers of distributing pictures that are directly understandable by a search engine. I also just think that this is like a really nice way of Google playing with this entire visual contextual experience, right? Like we talked about social media a bunch of times today. Social media is this highly visual, you know, somewhat contextual, but highly visual experience. And Google is realizing that that is literally the consumer world that we live in. And a lot of our experiences rely on the real pictures, not curated pictures, the real pictures of other humans just like us. So this is a really interesting new feature. You know, this is going to live in a couple of different places, both on the Google search result page and the image result page, as well as in the maps.google.com experience as well, both native application on your favorite mobile device, all over the place. So this will be a nice addition. This will be a nice addition to Google search, sure.
I'm really excited about this for a couple of strange reasons. So like, I know this is like the smallest little tweak, but like Google's made so much investment over the years in their local guides program. And then so much of that user generated content data is like just right into a Google My Business listing. And like, I mean, in candor, I mean, I do this for a living, but that's also a lot of times like how I find out like hours to a restaurant, a pharmacy, a doctor's office. And there's so many local restaurants around here that like we're doing a lot of like takeout nowadays, right? And there's so many places where we want to go to them, but like they don't have a website, they don't have online order. That's fine, right? Like I don't care about that. But like I can't even find a picture of a menu because no one's, you know, scanned it and taken a picture of it. I feel like this solves a lot of those kind of bespoke things of like, just do it forward. Like, I don't want to leave a review. I just want like this asset here. And then, I mean, we all know Google's gotten really good at like OCR, optical character recognition, where they basically can scan the asset, diagnose what it is, figure out words, match it back to some sort of data dictionary, and like, boom, you've translated all the text. I mean, that's been in Evernote for a decade. And it's like, that type of stuff to me is like really exciting. But then Justin, to your point about like, it could be pictures of landscapes, national parks. Like, I don't want to review Mount Rushmore, but I want to share my photos up there. Like, this, I think, is either going to go, it's going to get spammed to death, or it's going to be, or it could actually be wildly valuable. And I have no idea what's going to happen.
Personally, I love this because the amount of times where we're planning something, mainly around dining, but you go onto Instagram and you search the location to find out what the kind of real, in air quotes, experiences. Again, Mount Rushmore. We planned a 2-week vacation.
Exactly right.
You do your research on Google, and then you're like, okay, let me go and see what other people have taken pictures of that experience for, and if I can get that within one environment,
yeah,
cool. I no longer have to go and search on Instagram.
It's the local guide, right? The local guide to the experience that we're looking for. Like, where's the little nooks and crannies that I need to know about Mount Rushmore? Is there like this like hidden trail off of this highway that like nobody knows about except the one guy that took a picture and now can post about it? I agree with you though, Mike. I think that it's like a, you know, I wonder what the regulation of it is. I wonder what like the checks and balances experience will be of the search engine to categorize it and keep it accurate. And like, will it get spammed with garbage? Will it be, you know, just a bunch of irrelevant and, you know, unrelated content? I don't know, but I see it as a benefit, you know, for first and foremost as a consumer benefit. We'll see how it shakes out.
Well, Justin, thank you for joining us on this wonderful spring day. We loved talking the news with you. Anything you want to plug while you're here? Any places we can find you?
Sure. You know, I'm definitely available on LinkedIn. Love to connect with anybody from a professional perspective, talk search, talk digital, anything like that. You know, I got to plug Bright Edge. Bright Edge has given me a career that I don't know I could find anywhere else. And I have the pleasure of working with some of the most recognizable brands on the planet with incredibly intelligent folks such as yourselves on a daily basis. And, in the pleasure of my professional career to build myself on their back. So shout out to Bright Edge and shout out to Marriott.
All right. Well, thank you for the kind words. If you like the podcast, you know where to find us. Feel free to leave a review in the iTunes store. Yes, that's still a thing. And yes, it actually does matter. Helps us get a little bit more visibility and some views. Give us some feedback, drop us a line. We've got a blog. We're at MDS_decoded on Twitter and MDS@Marriott.com. We'll be back in a couple more weeks with an interview with Adam that Chris teased, and have a great day.